This is Making Waves. We continue our look at the American way and freedom with a segment from Voices of Our World on the economic system in the United States.
Welcome to Voices of Our World, a presentation of this station and Mary Knoll. I'm your host, Eileen Bott. For better or worse, we live in a capitalist society. At its best, this leads to increased creativity, freedom, and entrepreneurship among citizens. At its worst, it can lead to stratified society with a great divide between the haves and the have-nots. In our colorblind society, where fairness and equality are supposed to be the law of the land, it often seems that those who tend to capitalize in terms of economic wealth are mostly rich white men. In America, rich white men have undoubtedly been the dominant force in American business, military, politics, and law since the Declaration of Independence. So it's no coincidence that they have been in a position to realize their American dreams of wealth, power, and influence. But sadly, this white man's dream has come at the expense of the women, blacks, and immigrants who have been systematically denied their rights and opportunities to realize their own dreams, despite the fact that they played by the rules. Today we explore how many rich white men have historically used their legal, political, and economic power to prevent others from accumulating wealth, and to make sure that the true color of wealth in America is not green, but white. Our guests today are Meju Louie, author of The Color of Wealth, and Lee Farris, senior organizer on estate tax policy for United for a Fair Economy. In a competitive system like capitalism, there are bound to be winners and losers. But what if the winners kept changing the rules so that the losers never had a chance? And what if the winners were all the same color and gender? Well, to most of us, that would be pretty unfair, or perhaps even corrupt. But that is exactly what has been going on in America for the last 230 years. Money is power, and rich white men have used their money and power to rig the game in their favor. A new book titled The Color of Wealth examines precisely how minorities, women, and immigrants have historically been the victims of the morally bankrupt political, legal, and economic policies of white men in America. Predictably, the consequences of the unjust laws and double standards imposed by these powerful men are still haunting us today. Our Michael Jones talks with one of the authors of The Color of Wealth, Meju Louie.
Thank you for joining us today. After reading your book, one thing is readily apparent. The color of wealth isn't green, it's white. So let's begin with the most obvious question. In a country like ours, where capitalism is a way of life, wealth tends to be the most important indicator of one's success. But what exactly is wealth? Is it different than just being rich? How do you go about defining who's rich and who is poor?
Wealth is really about achieving the American dream, and the American dream is about having economic security and the ability to rise up and to have your children do better than you did. So I think that means knowing that you're not going to die in poverty when you're old, that you're not going to have health problems and not be able to take care of them, that if you're unemployed for a while, that you're not going to be able to survive that little storm there. So if you think of income as a river and wealth as more like a little lake, then you can see that income just comes in and out, but wealth is a pool that you can draw from when times are hard or just to sustain yourself and your next generation of children.
Could you please tell us a little bit about your personal background and experience and how it led to you being interested in the accumulation and the distribution of wealth here in America?
Well, yeah, I grew up, I'm Chinese American. I was born in this country, but my parents are both immigrants. And I was curious about a number of things. And I should just say that this book was written by five women, and we didn't start with data. We started with our family stories and answering some questions that we had. And looking at the situation today, we see that people of color are still behind whites in the economy. And the story that we hear out there in the public is, well, there's a culture of poverty, or they just don't want to work, or they just stick to themselves and don't want to participate, all of those kinds of stories. And so we really thought we needed to delve into this and find the answers, the real answers to those questions.
Many people seem unaware of some of the historical reasons the color of wealth has tended to be white, and often the rich claim that the poor are lazy or stupid or even unlucky. But your research has shown that it has nothing to do with this. It has a lot more to do with racism and greed.
Absolutely. Well, actually, one thing I'd like to say is that if it's true that hard work is the only reason for getting wealthy, then the slaves should have been the wealthiest people in the United States at that time. And certainly the fact that slave owners, who, by the way, made a culture of not working, I mean, it was really shameful to work for that class of people, and yet their descendants are doing quite well on the basis of lack of work, while the descendants of those who were doing all the work still have less.
Now, some say that capitalism as a financial structure actually needs an underclass. Do you subscribe to that belief?
I do not subscribe to that. I think that if we have a government which helps to distribute the resources of the country in a fair way, then that doesn't have to happen. And in fact, that's the subject of The Color of Wealth. It shows how the government repeatedly, and to its credit, created boosts for white working families to give them a chance to climb that economic ladder of success.
Well, could you please tell us a little bit about how some of these lazy white landowners may have drafted society or built society to basically benefit them?
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, if you go back to the very beginning in terms of the Constitution, at first it wasn't that all white people could vote. It was white men of property that could vote. So even working class white people were excluded. So definitely the idea was that it was people of property that should gain from the United States. On the other hand, the Constitution is an interesting document that it also put into it that all men are created equal and that everybody has a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And I'm glad they put that in because that gives us a basis for trying to make good on that promise. And ever since the country was founded, there have been people agitating to say, wait a minute, what about those clauses? What about us?
Well, how is this wealth accumulated on the backs of slaves and immigrants, how has that wealth been transferred from generation to generation? How exactly has the game been rigged to protect the, I guess, these immoral accumulation and accruance of wealth by the rich white landowners who started this country?
Well, I think wealth is just passed along, and there aren't really a lot of rules that would take that away, except for tax policies. And we have in this country enacted tax policies that have taxed the richer at a higher rate than the poorer, partly because there's a sense that they have benefited the most and that they have the wherewithal to create the public programs that might help another group of people get a toehold as well. So there has been one strand of U.S. history that has encouraged the wealthy and has actually mandated that the wealthy pay more in terms of not so much in terms of percentages. So, for example, at the end of World War II, the top tax rate was 91%, and nobody said boo. It was considered that that was a fair thing to do, to contribute what you had to a country that was at that time at war.
Currently, there seems to be a lot of people out there claiming that instead of focusing solely on race as a factor in determining the inequality of wealth in society, we should just concentrate strictly on the poor. What is wrong with the colorblind approach to poverty?
Well, the thing that's wrong about it is it doesn't really recognize reality. We have a very disproportionate number of people of color that are poor, so we really have to look again at history and what are the reasons for that in order to solve that problem if our goal is to eliminate poverty for everyone. I think when we looked at the history of some of the laws, we saw that programs that were considered universal or not based on race ended up benefiting whites. So even if you look at a program like Social Security, which we all take for granted is a universal program that everyone is entitled to, it that has put in a certain amount of work in the United States, when the law was passed in 1935, there were two occupations that were left out of it, domestic workers and agricultural workers, and those were the two occupations that had mostly Latinos and African Americans. So, for example, 85% of all African American women in the South were domestic workers, working just as hard as anyone else, as people in the manufacturing sector, I would argue perhaps working harder, but did not get Social Security. It is dangerous to not look at the details of some of these policy programs, and we feel that it would be great to have new programs that help white people who are poor get a leg up as well.
Okay, let's fast forward 20-some-odd years. and let's just say America's wealth has been subtly redistributed amongst the people more evenly. How would that change the face of America?
Well, for one thing, I don't think if you look at the House of Congress, you would see like all these just white male faces. It's kind of shocking, given the population of the United States today, that we still have that the white men still have such a monopoly on positions of power. So I think that we would see just a much more diversity in our leadership group. But I think what that would translate into is that we would have many more ways of doing things, and we would see an injection of creative new ways to solve some of our country's problems. Just an example from Asia, I used to do some work in the health field, and I remember when the idea of acupuncture was first introduced, people in the white society were like, are they crazy sticking needles in people? Is going to help them in any kind of way? And yet adopting acupuncture has now become something, a therapy that helps people of all races, and it's used widespread, in a widespread way among all of the population. So similarly, I think we're going to just see, as we open up our minds to more different ways of doing things, we're going to just open up a whole new areas of creativity and ingenuity.
It seems like the quintessential question in any capitalist society is what is it going to do for me? And when you saw to the still rich white landowners of America, what is wealth redistribution and more equality going to actually do for them? What are the tangible positive benefits that they would be able to receive?
Well, I think, first of all, they are concerned about their children and their grandchildren, and I think they want to see them coming into the world. I think they want to leave behind, just as the rest of us do, a society that is better than what they had when they got here. And there are many people of wealth who say, you know what, what's important is not that I have one more $1 million, but what is important is that I am able to live in a society where there is freedom, where there is a feeling of security among all of us. This idea of having to live in a walled community at the top and then having people walled off and incarcerated at the bottom end, that is not the kind of free society that I think any of us would envision.
Do you have a website we could visit for more information about your organization?
You can go to colorofwealth.org or fareconomy.org, and that will get there as well. So I really appreciate this opportunity.
You're listening to Voices of Our World. As the saying goes, nothing is certain but death and taxes. But let's say you are certainly going to be taxed after your death. That would surely give Ben Franklin something to think about. But for some Americans, this is exactly what awaits them upon their death. The estate tax was designed in part to prevent super-rich families from hoarding their wealth and assets as they pass them from generation to generation. In theory, the estate tax was intended to actually encourage the flow of wealth and to spread prosperity. Currently, the estate tax only affects 0.27% of all American families. Hardly a large slice of the American pie, but it is projected that if the estate tax is repealed, it would cost the U.S. Treasury $1 trillion over the next 10 years. Given our massive deficits, the tragedy of Katrina, the war on terror, this money is sorely needed for everything, from body armor to interstate highways to school textbooks and to the police. Yet, some rich Americans feel that they are unfairly overtaxed and penalized for simply being successful, and they will no longer tolerate paying more than their fair share. It's not a matter of need for these incredibly rich families. It's a matter of greed. Using a campaign of deception and fear, these families have tricked many into falsely believing that the estate tax will affect them. They have tried repeatedly to bring the repeal of the estate tax before Congress, and the battle is just beginning. Voices of Our World is pleased to have with us today Lee Farris, Senior Advisor on the Estate Tax for United for a Fair Economy, to discuss the history of the estate tax and how a few greedy rich families want to be even richer, even at the expense of middle class and poor Americans.
Thank you for joining us today. We're talking to Lee Farris, the Senior Organizer on Estate Tax Policy at United for a Fair Economy. Please tell us a little information about the history of the estate tax. Why are some calling it the death tax?
why do they call it the death tax? Well, let's start with what is the estate tax first. The estate tax is a tax that a tiny quarter or so percent of people pay on their estates when they die and their estates are passed on to their heirs. And you have to have more than $2 million per spouse, so a married couple can pass on $4 million tax-free to their heirs before there is any estate tax. However, the opponents of the estate tax call it the death tax because they want to make it sound like everybody has to pay the estate tax. And they want to make it sound like you have to pay a tax in order to die. They want to make it sound like it's a tax on death. It is instead a tax on the accumulated wealth of the country's very, very richest people at the time that they pass on. And people do have 9 months before they have to file any tax forms about it. And extensions beyond that time are very common. So it's not a case that the government is sort of sending the tax man to the funeral or something like that. There's quite a bit of time for people to get their papers in order. The phrase death tax polls well in terms of getting people to dislike the tax. It increases the amount of people that dislike the tax by about 10% in most polls. So that's why the right-wing group headed by Grover Norquist started a pizza fund where they said every time that somebody says estate tax instead of death tax, you're going to have to put a quarter in the pizza fund and treat everybody to lunch. And they've had a lot of message discipline on that.
Who exactly are the opponents, as you said, of the estate tax? Are they rich families? Are they politicians? What class of society do they actually come from?
There are a variety of opponents of the estate tax. I think I would put them in three main groups. One is the very, very wealthy families, some of the very, very wealthy families that would be affected by the estate tax. So United for a Fair Economy and Public Citizen did a really interesting report detailing the lobby spending of 18 of the country's richest families that have been involved on the estate tax issue. And so these families and the companies that they're involved with have spent hundreds of millions of dollars so that they can save $72 billion collectively. The estate tax is repealed. They have put out a lot of misleading ads on TV, often ads that are full of downright factual lies. Those groups have now bought the view that the estate tax hurts small businesses and farms, despite the overwhelming evidence from the federal government that very small percent of farm or business estates have to pay any estate tax because, unfortunately for them, they aren't worth $4 million at the time that they die. So they then join into this effort to get rid of the estate tax and make it look like the estate tax hurts the corner store or the, friendly farmer down the road, when in fact it does not.
If you're just joining us, this is Voices of Our World, and we're talking with Lee Farris, Senior Advisor on the Estate Tax for United for a Fair Economy. It's pretty easy to ridicule the rich for complaining about high taxes, but there is a powerful and effective lobby fighting on behalf of some of America's richest and most influential families to repeal or reform the estate tax permanently. These families often use the power of political donations and campaign funding to convince some politicians of the evils of the death tax and to force them to draft legislation that would eliminate or greatly weaken it. But is there a moral obligation for the rich to pay more in taxes? Couldn't the estate tax be seen as a way for the richest Americans to further contribute to the land that helped to make them rich? With great power comes great responsibility. And in this time of crisis, shouldn't more be expected of America's richest citizens? We continue our discussion with Lee Farris, Senior Advisor on the Estate Tax for United for a Fair Economy.
So if the estate tax was indeed repealed, how much money are we talking about? How much money would the U.S. government be deprived of?
If the the estate tax were repealed, and that repeal started in the year 2011, then the first 10 years of repeal would cost the government almost $1 trillion by the time that you include interest on the deficit. And that's just a huge amount of money to throw away that would only benefit Paris Hilton-type heirs, people who have not worked for their inheritance. And it would be giving them money tax-free that everybody else has to pay taxes on what they earned. So part of our argument is that if you're going to tax wages, you should at least tax inherited money at least as much as wages. But really, inherited money is more like winning the birth lottery, so it should be taxed more like lottery winnings.
Well, what is the main argument other than greed used by the side who wants to repeal the estate tax? Don't they perceive the tax as being unfair to them? And if so, why?
I think that one argument is that they use a lot is that I earned this money, so I should be able to do what I want with it, whether give it to my kids or whatever. In response to that argument, I say, well, that's really not how taxes in our society work. I earn my salary and I pay income taxes on it, whether I want to or not. So much of the money that the estate tax is taxing is money that has, in fact, never been taxed. It's like if I go and take my salary and I buy a $100,000 house, and by the time that I die because of real estate appreciation, which is because of how all of us are making the economy better and stronger, let's say my house is worth $5 million, well, I haven't paid any taxes on that increased value. So when I die, it's appropriate that the increase in that value is taxed.
Given the fact that right now we have a war going on and you mentioned our budget deficit, couldn't the estate tax be seen as a way for the rich to claim that they are sacrificing something during this time of crisis? They don't go and fight in Iraq, and a $3 gallon of gas doesn't bother them, and they get to enjoy this surging stock market. Isn't the tax their way of basically just giving back?
Well, that is another argument that Bill Gates Sr. and other wealthy people do make on the estate tax. Until President Bush, there has never been a time that we've been in a serious war when there has been tax cuts at all, much less tax cuts for the wealthy. Instead, what usually happens during a war is taxes go up to fund the war, and particularly they go up on the wealthy. And President Bush is the first one to try to have a major expensive war and to have major tax cuts that primarily benefit the wealthy. Certainly, there are many wealthy people who would argue that this is the wrong time to decrease taxes on the wealthy, and the war particularly makes it a bad time to get rid of the estate tax.
Given the situation we find ourselves in with the deficit, with the country basically at each other's throat over Iraq, how much should the rich actually be forced to be taxed? What is their actual responsibility to the nation? Should the wealthy be almost exploited because of their wealth and basically have to put up with it? Or is there a compromise somewhere that you think could be reached between those who want to kill government off and those who want to exploit the rich?
I think we're a long way away from exploiting the rich. We need to think about what kind of country do we want to live in. Do we want to live in a country that has a hereditary aristocracy virtually by having ultra-wealthy families hand on wealth generation after generation after generation? I think that's what a lot of the founders of the United States came over to the United States away from Europe to get away from. The estate tax is one way of helping to put a brake on the increasing economic inequality in the United States. If we get rid of the estate tax, economic inequality will increase even more rapidly than it currently is. And so I think there is room for making a better estate tax, but United for a Fair Economy's proposal on what we would like the estate tax to look like is we would like to stay with the current level of funds that are exempted, which is $2 million per person, $4 million for a married couple. We do have a website. The website is www.fairEconomy.org, and there is a wealth of information about the estate tax and also about all the different other things that United for a Fair Economy is doing.
Well, thank you for joining us today, Lee Ferris, Senior Organizer on Estate Tax Policy at United for a Fair Economy.
Meju Louis and Lee Ferris are just two of the voices of our world. I'm your host for this week's show, Eileen Bott. Today's producer is Michael Jones. Our website is www.voicesofourworld.org, where you can listen, learn more about today's guests and topics, answer our weekly question, or subscribe to our podcast. Please go to www.voicesofourworld.org.
Magazine, boardroom, pop star, pinstripe, profit, peckerhead, greed. You say trust me with the money, the keys to the universe. Trickle down will give us everything we need. Brand new century, private penitentiary, bank vault, utopia padded for the few. Tumors for the masses, coughing for the masses, earphones for the masses, and they all serve you. Trickle down, give them the business. Trickle down, supposed to give us the goods. Cups held out to catch a bit of the bounty. Trickle down everywhere, trickle down. For education, now looks more like ignoration. Take the people's money and slip it to the corporation. Yellow rain, golden shower, pesticide, firepower, summon feudal demons of sweatshop subjugation. Work fair, foul air, homeless beggars everywhere. Picture phone aristocrats lounge around the pool. Captains of industry smiling beneficently, leaky hull, super tanker, ship of fools. Trickle down, give them a business. Trickle down, supposed to give us the goods. Cups held out to catch a bit of the bounty. Trickle down everywhere, trickle down. Thank you.
That was Trickle Down by Bruce Cockburn. You're listening to Making Waves. And now we bring you Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present journalist and author Anthony Arno, who assesses the viability of the new Iraqi government's reconciliation plan. Marixi Mercado of UNICEF, who discusses the humanitarian crisis that has resulted from an international aid cutoff in the occupied Palestinian territories. And Heather Boucher, an economist with the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who looks at the congressional debate on raising the federal minimum wage. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Bush administration is engaged in an aggressive diplomatic campaign to stop Venezuela from winning a seat on the United Nations Security Council. U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has pressured Latin American nations to actively oppose Venezuela's bid for a two-year seat on the Security Council in an effort to isolate populist President Hugo Chavez. Instead, the Bush administration is supporting its ally Guatemala to fill the seat allotted to Latin America. The BBC has obtained a U.S. diplomatic note that insisted the Chavez government would seek to disrupt the working of the Security Council and use it for ideological grandstanding rather than constructive problem-solving. Venezuela's foreign minister, Ali Rodriguez, countered, "We will use our position to support peace and refuse all kinds of attacks on peaceful countries." According to the Los Angeles Times, Rice has already offered to sell Chile, a close American economic ally, F-16 fighter jets, but will refuse to train the pilots if the South American country votes to back Venezuela's bid. Chile's ambassador to the United Nations, Geraldo Munoz, says the country has remained independent from American influence by opposing the Iraq War and backing the International Criminal Court to investigate war crimes. 10 days after the last Israeli forces withdrew from the Gaza Strip, a small group of American Jewish leaders and several American Protestant officials visited the East Jerusalem headquarters of Sabil, a Palestinian Liberation Theology Center run by Palestinian Christian activist Reverend Naim Atik, who became a controversial figure amongst his guests. Rabbi Gary Breton Granator of the Anti-Defamation League pressed the Palestinian cleric on accepting Israel's right to exist, which he dodged. The ADL also complained about the writings of Atik's, accusing him of anti-Semitism. According to The Nation magazine, this confrontational meeting came at the end of a trip to bridge the growing divide between American Jews and mainline Protestant denominations. The rift was caused by the 2004 decision by the Presbyterian Church USA to divest itself of companies doing business in Israel which profit from the occupation of Palestinian territories. The United Church of Christ followed suit by adopting a similar policy which prompted outrage in the mainstream Jewish community. The World Council of Churches praised the divestment effort, while other Protestant churches like the Lutherans sought a middle ground. Meanwhile, some Christian denominations are frustrated with inaction after decades of resolutions calling for Israel to leave occupied Palestinian land. Presbyterian divestment advocate Donald Wagner contends, "It's time to say we are not going to benefit from other people's suffering." The London-based Guardian newspaper reports 500 million people who live in desert regions across the globe may find life increasingly difficult as temperatures rise and rainfall levels decrease. A report by the United Nations Environment Programme concludes that desert cities like Phoenix, Arizona and Riyadh, Saudi Arabia are living on borrowed time as water tables sink and rising salt levels make daily life increasingly difficult. Overall, the growing intensity of global warming and resulting climate change are the biggest threat to people and ecology of settlements near deserts, which seem to be suffering a greater impact than other regions. For example, the rainfall in Iran has declined 16% since 1980 near the Dashti Kabir Desert. Meanwhile, massive glaciers are melting, with an expected 40-80% decline in South Asia in the next century. The loss of the glaciers, which provide water to Bangladesh, Pakistan, China and India, will have a devastating effect on the populations. Andres Warren of the University College London, one of the UN report's authors, stated, "We risk not only losing astounding landscapes and ancient cultures, but also wild species that may hold the key to our survival." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
Last week, Congress debated bills relating to setting a timetable for a U.S. withdrawal from Iraq. The Republican-controlled Senate voted 87-13 to reject a measure that called for troops to withdraw from Iraq by July 2007. The Senate also rejected by a 60-39 vote a non-binding resolution that called for a withdrawal of troops, but with no specific timetable. A week earlier, the House had voted 256-153 for a Republican measure that stated the U.S. should stay in Iraq until its mission is completed. Although Republicans had charged Democrats with advocating a cut-and-run policy, the top U.S. military commander in Iraq has himself drafted a timetable for withdrawing up to 7,000 American troops by September. Meanwhile, Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki put forth a 24-point national reconciliation initiative on June 25th, offering amnesty to insurgents who renounce violence and have not engaged in terrorist attacks. Press reports indicated that some Sunni insurgent groups had expressed interest in discussing the plan with the government. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with journalist Anthony Arnove, whose latest book is titled Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal. He assesses the political debate in Washington and the viability of the new Iraqi government's reconciliation plan.
It's fairly interesting that the polls show a majority of people in this country opposed to this war. Polls also show a majority of soldiers, active duty troops on the ground in Iraq, wanting to withdraw. And really, the Democrats have failed to provide any coherent proposal for withdrawal. There was division between Democrats who wanted to stay the course, some Democrats who even want to send more troops to Iraq, such as Joe Lieberman of Connecticut, but others who advocate various positions that would involve some form of timetable. I, in my book, argue for immediate withdrawal rather than a prolonged timetable for withdrawal, but at least the idea of withdrawal was beginning to be aired. It's not surprising that Congress rejected that proposal, and it leaves us in a situation where I think we have to take very seriously the idea that this occupation will continue, quite likely, into the next administration. George Bush has said it's not up to him to decide when troops will leave Iraq, and an aide to Tony Blair, who's Bush's main ally in the occupation of Iraq, Britain has the second largest number of troops in Iraq, if you exclude private security firms, after the United States. He has a top aide who said that their scenario is staying in Iraq until 2010. So I'm not overly confident that the pressure that we now see building in Congress is going to lead to any kind of immediate resolution. I think it's going to take much more popular pressure to bring that about.
In other developments around Iraq, the new Iraqi Prime Minister Maliki has put forth a reconciliation plan that includes some amnesty for insurgents. Details are not all that clear at this moment, but what do you make of this plan? And is there any chance, as some press reports have suggested, that the insurgents are ready to sit down and talk?
Well, I'm skeptical. I think that this is more media hype than it is substance. We've seen a number of efforts of the Bush administration and the Iraqi government to say that we're turning a corner. This amnesty offer or this constitutional election or this referendum is going to end the violence and the instability and the insurgency in Iraq. And after every one of these turning points, the reality is it's only continued to get worse in Iraq. This May, the number of bodies that showed up in the Baghdad morgue was double the number from May 2005. In the first 6 months of this year, attacks against the coalition forces averaged 600 a week. That's up 13% from the end of 2005. And sectarian divisions have increased in the country. And really, I don't think al-Maliki's proposal gets at the root of the problem, which is that Iraqis overwhelmingly object to foreign occupation. And as long as the U.S. troops are there, as long as the U.S. is building military bases, as long as the U.S. is building its largest embassy in the world in Baghdad, and as long as effectively the U.S. is calling the shots economically, militarily, politically, which they are, the resistance, the opposition, the violence is going to continue.
Anthony, tell us a little bit about the influence, if any, that peace groups and anti-war Iraq veterans organizations have had on the course of the war policy in Washington and what they may be able to do in the coming months as the midterm congressional elections approach.
Well, I think that's a crucial question. I think the peace movement, the veterans movement, has already had a significant impact. There's no question that the debate that's now happening in Congress came about as a result of the opinion polls, the popular pressure that Congress is beginning to feel, the polls that show a majority now opposing the war, that show George Bush having the lowest approval rating of any president in modern history other than Richard Nixon at the height of the Watergate scandal, and showing that people oppose actually both the Democrats and Republicans' stance on the war. So there's a situation where I think we've begun to have an impact. We've shifted public opinion. We've shifted the nature of the debate in this country. Much more needs to be done, and I'm particularly encouraged that groups like Iraq Veterans Against War, the group of veterans from this conflict modeled on Vietnam Veterans Against the War, is out there mobilizing, giving voice to soldiers who've been in Iraq, who've seen firsthand the horrors of this occupation, and who are speaking out against it. And they have three very simple demands: immediate withdrawal of troops, reparations for the Iraqi people, which I think is a very important demand to be coupled with the idea of withdrawal so that we don't just abandon the Iraqis, and also money to be spent on veterans. You know, this government says support our troops, by which they only mean support the government that needlessly sends our troops in harm's way. Don't provide them with education or health care or jobs or any of the things that they're promised when they enlist. Don't actually support the troops in any meaningful sense, but send them off to die. And so it's important to talk about those issues. And I'm also encouraged that people are making connections between civil liberties issues at home, the war on immigrants and poor people and working people, and the war on our civil liberties that's gone hand in hand with this war in Iraq.
That was journalist Anthony Arnove, whose latest book is titled Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal. Read his articles online at www.zmag.org. Violence and hardship have escalated in the Palestinian territories, Gaza and the West Bank, since Hamas came to power in March of this year. Hamas does not recognize Israel's right to exist, and the international community responded with an aid cutoff. However, Hamas is now in negotiations with Fatah, its political rival, over a document that would recognize Israel's right to exist and negotiate a two-state solution. Tensions have increased during the month of June, with the killing of at least 20 Palestinian civilians, as well as the assassination of two Palestinian militants in Gaza by the Israeli Defense Force. On June 25th, Palestinian militants, including members of Hamas, tunneled into Israel underneath a Gaza border crossing in retaliation, they said, for recent Israeli attacks, and killed two Israeli soldiers and captured another. Israel has vowed that Palestinians will pay a heavy price for this incursion, especially if the soldier is not returned unharmed. After the attack, Israel closed the border crossings, the only way people and goods can enter or exit the territory. Previous closings have created widespread hardships. Gaza is home to 1.3 million people crammed onto 140 square miles, much of it desert, less than a tenth the size of Rhode Island. Children suffer disproportionately from the violence and from the lack of food and medical care. UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund, released a statement in mid-June warning that one in three newborns in Gaza is at risk of dying due to the lack of medicines and emergency medical equipment in hospitals. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Marixi Mercado, communications officer with UNICEF's humanitarian aid programs in the Occupied Palestinian Territories, or OPT. She describes the current crisis and explains what UNICEF does in Palestine to improve the lives of children in the current climate.
I've just actually come back from the territory about 2 weeks ago, and I can tell you that in May, central stocks of like some critical medicines were at or near zero levels in central warehouses. What UNICEF has done, particularly with respect to health, in particular to deal with that, we've procured, I think, about $1.2 million worth of essential drugs and medicines. For the over 400 primary health clinics and 17 general hospitals in Gaza. And these supplies and equipment include a whole array of supplies and materials, particularly for the neonatal units in the 17 general hospitals within the territories. And so basically we've identified newborn mortality as a huge issue, and we're bringing in the drugs and the supplies that are needed to really deal with it. I mean, if I think, as I was briefed a little bit on this by a doctor, and what he told me was that essentially the primary reasons for death are prematurity and low birth weight, and that basically essentially with good hospital facilities, all children who are born with these conditions can make it, but under current circumstances, because of the lack of facilities to, for example, maintain regular body temperature or maintain good breathing or drugs to treat complications, these are why mortality rates are rising now.
We hear a lot in the U.S. about all the Qassam rockets that the Palestinians in Gaza are firing into Israel, and they've injured a few people, but I don't think they've killed anyone, as far as I know. But I just read an article in the New York Times that indicated Israel is firing a lot more into Gaza than vice versa, and at least 19 Palestinian civilians, including many children, have been killed in the past month by Israeli shelling.
In the last 3 months, Palestinians have fired 479 homemade rockets towards Israel, and during the same period, the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, have fired 7,599 artillery shells into the Gaza Strip.
So what kind of impact from that shelling is UNICEF dealing with?
Basically, you're living in the context of constant shelling. This is something that you hear all the time. You don't even blink anymore. It's just the context of extraordinary violence and insecurity, particularly for kids. I mean, there's an increasing risk, I understand, of kids coming into contact with unexploded ordnance because of areas, for example, that in Gaza had been previously closed off to them, which are now open to them. It's something that has been going on for a long, long time. It's just now that things have escalated now.
Marixi Mercado, what does UNICEF do exactly in the occupied Palestinian territories?
UNICEF procures the entire vaccine requirement along with a wide range of essential drugs and supplies. With our partners on the ground, we conduct immunization campaigns and provide services that reach areas without health clinics. We upgrade facilities, train health workers, and help deal with new threats like avian flu. We help make sure that children can keep studying despite checkpoints, closures, and other military activity. We've developed these remedial worksheets in math, science, Arabic, and English that basically allow students who are forced to stay home to either keep up with their studies, or when they get to school and the teachers can't get there to continue studying anyway. We've worked with communities across the territory to develop safe play areas where basically young people can be young. I mean, they're living in a context of extraordinary violence, and there are not a lot of safe places for them to just be young. And so working with communities, we've established, I think, 41 safe play areas across the territories. And in these places, we have trained animators who give guidance and can help them develop skills, that go from computer literacy to drama. And I guess the other key thing that we do is we have 12 psychosocial teams across Gaza and the West Bank who work with parents and children to help them deal with the overwhelming level of conflict-induced stress. And particularly during emergencies, these teams, they visit homes and hospitals.
If restrictions to Palestinians' movement are not eased and Palestinian government workers can't get paid soon and food and medical care made more easily available, what is your prognosis for Palestinian children and all civilians in the occupied territories?
The humanitarian outlook, not just for Gaza, but for the entire occupied Palestinian territory, it looks extremely bleak, and it's predicted to worsen dramatically.
That was Maritzi Mercado of UNICEF. For more information on UNICEF's work in Palestine, call area code 212-326-7261 or visit www.unicef.org. In the lead-up to this November's midterm election, Congress is debating an increase in the minimum wage, which has been unchanged since 1997. Senate Democrats had proposed raising the federal minimum wage from the current $5.15 an hour to $7.25 by January 2009. But the Republican-controlled Senate killed the proposal with a vote of 52-46, 8 short of the 60 needed for passage. Workers earning minimum wage make about $10,700 a year, only $900 above the official government poverty level. Advocates of a hike in the minimum wage say that an increase to a $7.25 hourly rate would put more than $4,000 in the pockets of 6.5 million Americans. Despite a freeze in the minimum wage for the last 9 years, 21 states and the District of Columbia have set the minimum wage above the federal level of $5.15. Opinion polls indicate the public overwhelmingly supports a minimum wage increase. While GOP leaders in the House of Representatives have opposed the measure, election year pressure may force the issue for a vote before the summer recess. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Heather Boucher, an economist with the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who looks at the congressional debate on raising the federal minimum wage.
If we don't raise the minimum wage by December, that'll be the longest period of time over which we have not raised the minimum wage since the minimum wage was established as part of the Fair Labor Standards Act. So the fact that the House and the Senate are trying to move on this is very important, because that's certainly a goal we'd like to meet.
As you read editorials and different articles on the issue of the minimum wage being raised, there's a lot of discussion about the effect on the economy. There are some conservative economists who say a minimum wage makes it harder on employers, which in turn would make it more difficult to hire large numbers of people, depressing the economy. But of course, there are others who say it will be a boon to the economy. What's your read of the effect of the minimum wage?
Well, I think that overall it would be good for the economy. If we raise the federal minimum wage to $7.25 per hour for the next couple of years, as opposed, which was proposed in the bill, that would raise the annual earnings of the average full-time, full-year minimum wage worker by a little over $1,500 a year. And we know that folks who are at the bottom end of the income spectrum, if you give them an extra dollar, they'll go out and spend it. So those families will have an extra $1,500 a year to go out and spend on goods and services. That's enough to afford about 9 months' worth of groceries for those families or a whole host of other goods. So that really would be good for low-wage communities and for the businesses that serve those families. And, you know, one of the other questions that people always ask, or that one of the criticisms, is that if you raise the minimum wage, employers are going to have to lay a bunch of people off. And that certainly has not been the case in the past. That's not what we've seen. And right now, the majority of Americans live in a state that has a minimum wage higher than the federal minimum, and we haven't seen a huge disemployment effect from those movements. So certainly, if we raise the minimum wage, it would put more money in the hands of people who will spend it, and it's likely to improve their economic well-being and add to their ability to spend without creating disemployment.
Heather, tell us a little bit about who makes the minimum wage now. A lot of conservative pundits, Rush Limbaugh comes to mind, say, well, it's just kids, just, you know, 16-year-olds who make minimum wage. But from my read of the statistics, that's not exactly true.
No, it's not true. And while it is true, of course, that a lot of teenagers do earn the minimum wage, a lot of people who are working their way through college earn the minimum wage, It is true that 50%, over half, of minimum wage workers are between the ages of 25 and 54. That is, they're prime age workers, they're adults. So over half of minimum wage workers are adults. And among those who earn the minimum wage, they contribute a little bit over two-thirds of their total family income. So among, you know, all the households, all the families that have a minimum wage worker, that minimum wage worker is a significant contributor to the total family income. The third point is that among prime age workers, those folks between 25 and 54, about a third of them are still stuck in a minimum wage job 3 years later. So there's not a lot of mobility out of minimum wage jobs. There's certainly not as much mobility as the folks who are against raising the minimum wage would like to suggest. If a third of folks who are earning at the minimum wage are still in minimum wage jobs 3 years later, and these are adults, again, prime age workers, that really does signify an important problem that having such a low minimum wage sets for these workers and their families. But it also goes against the criticism that it doesn't really affect a lot of families or that it's just teenagers or something. These are real sort of working adults, and they're having a hard time moving out of those jobs.
We have many indications that there is a growing disparity between rich and poor in the United States, unlike we've seen in many decades. How does the minimum wage fit into this picture? Does it significantly alter the downward spiral in terms of this gap between the wealthy and the poorest in the country?
Well, the minimum wage is a floor, right? It's the bottom of the wage distribution. And what we've seen over the past few years is that the minimum wage is at its lowest point in 50 years. Inequality is at one of its highest points, if not its highest point. And the gap between the median worker and the minimum wage worker is also at a historic high. So you're seeing an increased dispersion of incomes and of wages, so that some folks have benefited during this economic recovery, those at the very top of the wage distribution, while minimum wage workers have only seen their real take-home pay decline over the past few years. Of course, it's also true that median family income in America today is lower than it was back at the end of the last recovery in 1999, the lack of maintaining a solid floor for the bottom end of the labor market has been a very important part of this increasing economic inequality that we've been seeing over the past few decades.
That was Heather Boucher, an economist with the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Contact the center by calling area code 202-293-5380. Or visit their website at www.cepr.net. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Capron, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Joanne Paradise, and Damon Thomas. We welcome your participation too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. Our theme music is by New Hampshire women's drum group Tabalat, and our mid-show music is Evening Stars by Alice Gomez. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you're not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Remember that WSCA is growing and hoping for your membership and participation. www.wscafm.org to join and learn more. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. We leave you today with this quote by Robert Hayden, poet and educator. We must not be frightened nor cajoled into accepting evil as deliverance from evil. We must go on struggling to be human, though monsters of abstractions police and threaten us.